Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
And with the words, "Everything okay, Meneer," we obviously look at one of Harry's wonderful sort of possible incarnations becoming a prison guard in South Africa. Or maybe with that line, "Everything okay, Meneer," we should actually look to Richard Fitzwilliams, because obviously, Richard, you were there at the heart of the whole South African scenario, were you not?
Well, you know, Alex, I have to say this, and I have to be frank. I'm very impressed with your accent. I think it's very practiced, and I think that you should have acted in this film.
The joys of having a vice chancellor who comes from South Africa. Anyway, enough of such stuff. We welcome, of course, Robin Pierce and Richard Fitzwilliams, who's just heard of. I don't know, do we go straight into International Women's Day and the celebration of freedom that will be cried throughout Oprah Winfrey by, of course, the wondrous Meghan, and the fact that for some bizarre reason, you know, the palace seems to be discovering accusations of bullying and all sorts of things. I mean, it's an own goal, isn't it, from a public relations point of view, Richard? All of this battling over a fairly ill Prince Philip.
Well, this whole thing, of course, is turning into a circus. And indeed, this has been the case for the whole week. I would say that at least the news about Prince Philip would appear to be encouraging. But on the other hand, he's 99. And my feeling was, and I've said this, it's been quoted extensively, that the interview should have been postponed whilst he was hospitalised. The problem, of course, I accept this obviously, is that the advertising, the hype, the whole thing, there were, in fact, 70 countries have taken it. I mean, it's quite literally out of anyone's control. But nonetheless, if a 99-year-old has a recurrence of the heart condition, this dates back to 2011 when he had emergency surgery, and we just wish him well. But as far as what has occurred, we've had three trailers. Now, here's the thing, and this brings in film. Oprah and Meghan and Harry briefly appearing. The first trailer, well, we all know the way trailers work, and you want to tantalise, you want to tease. So Oprah, Meghan says nothing. Harry refers back to the horror of what happened to his mother and says that it's something that could happen again, and we can feel for him in that. Then Oprah is shown responding to what she's heard and saying, you know, that's almost unsurvivable, or that's shocking. Well, it's doesn't give the context in which this is said. So it could be the press, it could be courtiers, it could be anyone. We don't know if it's individual royals or whatever. Then the second trailer, Meghan implies that the firm, which is what Prince Philip called the royal family, it isn't necessarily a sinister term, actually, that they are spying on her, words to that effect, leaking to a derogatory material.
Briefing against her.
Falsehoods are being leaked. And of course, this builds up a certain drama. But when I get the third trailer, I really start wondering what on earth she's learnt. Because apparently, this is an extraordinary thing. I mean, obviously she wasn't familiar with the royal family before she joined it, but Harry must have surely told her a certain amount. She still doesn't seem to realise, because it's so liberating talking to Oprah now, they're no longer senior working royals, but the thought that you would have, however eminent, and Oprah's the world's top chat show host, we know that, talk show host, we all know that, but the idea that before the wedding they could have had a sit down together, she still thinks that that is perfectly feasible, and that it's a construct, as she calls the royal family, that is some sort of immovable thing that prevents
it. If she wanted to get freebies from people who actually realised that they could actually promote their products by actually sending her freebies, surely that's par for the course. I mean, it's an essential part of things. I mean, you know, let's face it, you know, if you're marrying into royalty, you've got all of that challenge, you need to actually have as many new dresses as you can get from as many designer areas as you wish. I mean, it's just an essential thing, isn't it? Surely.
Well, I have to say that there's a very interesting article by Camilla Tominy in the Daily Telegraph today, and this article deals with the way, according to the royal sources and the sources that she's been talking to, Harry and Meghan behaved when they were working royals and before the marriage and subsequently, and the fact that basically she was impossible, because there are allegations of bullying. Sources have brought these up, just so happens before Sunday.
If you can't stand the heat, get out of the Meghan kitchen. I mean, this is the why they had to move, obviously, to the west coast of America, where they can actually sort of swan around, do lots of things. Richard, let's leave it. We'll see what actually happens. I'm sure it'll actually be dramatised very effectively, and I know you'd like to join Rebecca Bond, Robin Pierce and myself in hearty, hearty congratulations for the rich decision to actually award Gillian Anderson a Golden Globe for her tremendous portrayal of Margaret Thatcher in The Crown.
As I have pointed out, that the physicality of Thatcher was, and the fact that she looked like the Wicked Witch of the West, I didn't think it was impressive. I thought Meryl Streep in the
award-winning Army. Richard, award-winning.
Actually, Alex, since you bring that up now a second time, I'm just telling you this, that the Golden Globes and the Hollywood Foreign Press Association are not a saintly body. You won't have noticed this. Being, as it were, on the cloud nine yourself, you will not have seen this. But in actual fact, not only did they have one black member, but they also, Emily in Paris, now I only seen a little bit of it, but I think you found that intellectually challenging, and there it was, nominated, you see there. And of course, I know that you were very fond of Glenn Close and Hillbilly.
Indeed.
Yes, yes. I mean, the point what we're getting from them, Gillian Anderson did indeed get Globe, but I would point out Emma Corrin, as who plays Diana, beat as well. She might Olivia Colman, thank God for that. But I mean, it was an eccentric selection, but equally, Crown did very well. This was, I think, expected. On the other hand, I'm delighted that Anya Taylor-Joy, who looked absolutely gorgeous, by the way, I put up a post, because she glammed up wonderfully for these virtual awards, did very well with The Queen's Gambit, which I'm delighted about. And she was so good as Emma, too, you see. So,
Let's progress, Richard. We'll leave them to celebrate their wonderful trinkets that they were awarded for, obviously, true wonderful work, because let's face it, they earn so much in terms of the joy that they give us, that it's much better than the, shall we say, I don't know, what the NHS people actually do for us, but at least the government recognises that, so that's fine. Let's move on to that classic movie, of course, Escape from Azkaban, featuring Harry Potter, in which he actually has to deal with South African guards and all sorts of other things, because his mother, actually, Daniel Radcliffe's mother, was obviously from South Africa as well. So clearly this is a role where once again he can demonstrate his tremendous range of bottom acting, which of course he's demonstrated to great effect in previous movies, such as, of course, dealing with a flatulent corpse a wee while back. But there we are. That was his portrayal. I know, Richard, you'd appreciate that particular one. But let's move on to, of course, as I say, Everything Okay, Mynheer. Off you go, Richard. Escape from Pretoria. Yes.
This film is called Escape from Pretoria. It's set during the period of the apartheid regime in 1978. And actually, I rather recommend it as an adventure thriller that I thought worked overall rather well. We have two, they're both whites, Tim Jenkin, played by Daniel Radcliffe, and Stephen Lee, played by Daniel Webber. This is a true story, which is important to emphasize that. They're sentenced for placing devices which scatter anti-apartheid leaflets, and also they're members of the African National Congress. Sentenced by a judge whose South African accent is very bad, I have to say, in a film which overall shows a pretty good attention to this. To Jenkin for 12 years and Lee to 8 years in Pretoria prison. And there they meet Dennis Goldberg, played by Ian Hart. He's a prisoner who was sentenced with Mandela and Sisulu. They were sent to Robben Island. Dennis Goldberg.
You can't have them in the same jail, not in a apartheid South Africa, for goodness sake.
How right you are. The whole place is, of course, quite crazy, but the characters, I have to say, in this are rather convincing. They're with another prisoner, Leonard Fontaine, played by Mark Leonard Winter, and plan an escape. And though sometimes the guards are suspicious and the other prisoners won't join them, and there's a very suspicious Captain Snapple, played by Grant Pirro, extremely nasty, but rather a good performance, I thought. How do you get out of a top security prison? Now, most of this
movie, you go to woodwork class, Richard. You go to woodwork class.
You do indeed. Now, I have to say that even though we know what happened, it's actually rather well done. It has a sort of docudrama feel about it. It concentrates, it's a documentary type movie on the comings and goings in prison, and an awful lot of it is filmed the shots are very dark because obviously in a prison they would be. From that point of view, unless you're involved, you feel involved, particularly involved in the struggle, which I do think has relevance for us today, and I was involved in it. And also, there are some very good extras, a type of Afrikaner that members of staff at the jail, who did certainly exist and sounded like that. I think it has fairly limited appeal, but nonetheless, I thought it was on the whole rather well done, and Daniel Radcliffe, I think it's rather good. Daniel Webber, also rather good. Yes, I do remember Alex when he played the Flatulent Corpse, and I did not like that. But on the other hand, this director, Francis Hannon, has gives us a feel for what that's quite an authentic feel. There are bits of dialogue which are slightly silly. Jenkin is referred to by one of the guards as the white Mandela, that sort of phrase. It's a little over-reverential sometimes, but it concentrates mainly on how the escape was planned and executed, and I rather liked it.
Thank you.
out of interest, Richard, a serious question. Were you actually in South Africa at the time these events were occurring, or were you growing up there? What was your particular routine, or had you left long before that?
No, I had left some years before that. But nonetheless, of course, I was interested in this, and it perhaps made it more interesting to me than it would be perhaps to others going back 40 years.
Rebecca Bond, did you manage to see Daniel Radcliffe attempting to actually insert something in a part of his body, which I just thought, don't do it, Daniel, don't do it, it's not appropriate.
I did indeed. I thought it was really good as a film. It's something that I wouldn't, you know, gravitate towards normally, but as I sat down to watch it, I found it was really attention-grabbing, it was suspenseful, I really enjoyed following the journey of, you know, the plan of the escape. I think the kind of the vulnerabilities you're allowed to see in Daniel Radcliffe's character as well, I think really endears the character to the audience. So I enjoyed following his journey. And I think it just goes to show that you don't have to be, you know, you can be an ordinary man to be a hero. So I think it was, I liked the journey. I liked following it. I think it was suspenseful. My heart rate was high again at one point on my Apple Watch when they were, you know, hiding from the guards. And, you know, it's really suspenseful. And that's what I enjoyed about it.
And I would give it an 8 out of 10 because I actually did enjoy it. Robin, did you manage to see it, or are you tempted to see Escape from... Oh, no, it's Dr. Pretorius. It's Frankenstein, Bride of... No, Escape from Pretoria.
So Ernest Thesiger is in this, is he? I'm very tempted to watch it. I got the word that you were covering it a little bit late in the day yesterday, and I thought maybe I'd get up early this morning, but, you know, that bed was a little bit too...
It's not a morning movie, Robin. It's a late night movie, honestly.
Well, I very much liked Midnight Express, and you know it seems to, from what I gather, it seems to have that kind of vibe. So yes, I will definitely be tuning into that one.
Well, as I said, I'd award 8 out of 10 for that. Unfortunately, despite Rosamund Pike, who's never really bettered her role in Die Another Day for me, it's probably going to be a 6 out of 10 for the next one. Do I care? I don't know. I care a lot. What say you, Robin, first of all, about I Care a Lot?
Well, I fancied this one. It was Rosamund Pike that actually kind of led me to see this because, like you, I enjoyed her very much in Die Another Day, and I thought she did an excellent job in Gone Girl. She seems to specialise in playing frosty villains. I mean, she's so cool. She's ice cool. She's calculating. And of course, she's also the voice of Lady Penelope, I believe, in the CGI Thunderbird incarnation. So I thought, okay.
Now at least she doesn't use the F-bomb there. That's the important thing. I mean, just imagine if she was using that with Parker. It would not be appropriate at all.
Well, when I read the synopsis on was it Amazon or was it Netflix? Netflix.
Amazon.
It's one or the other. I thought this would be one of those British dramas highlighting the plight of the elderly being abused. And I thought, okay, well, this might be a film with a social conscience. But it's only a few minutes into the film that you realise, well, you're in America and it's an entirely different kind of film. It is kind of a crime caper. Now, Rosamund Pike plays Marla Grayson. Now, she makes a very, very good living by having herself appointed the ward of old, vulnerable people with no relatives. If there are relatives, she'll just have them cut off completely. And she puts these people into care homes and basically sells off all of their property, pockets a hefty profit. She's making a wonderful living at this. With the aid of some people she has on the inside, in particular a doctor, she targets what appears to be a lonely old widow. She's got a very nice nest egg. She's played by Diane Wiest, playing the part of Jennifer Peterson. She owns her own property. She is a nest egg. So
a cherry, really, Robin, a cherry to indeed. Be precise.
Well, she's sitting on a nest egg, certainly, because she got all those antiques and stuff. So they move in. They confuse her by sending her into a home. She goes willingly because there are police officers around. She's stripped of all of her belongings. She can't even have a mobile phone. She's cut off. But as the film, I mean, this itself is good drama. The more, shall we say, fanciful and fantastical element comes in when they discover that the old lady is not what she seems, and she is, in fact,
she's from Game of Thrones,
very well connected to a Russian mafia don, played really well by Peter Dinklage from, as you say, Game of Thrones.
And X-Men Days of Future Past.
Well, if you want to go to that one, okay. I thought I'd give him a high. Let's go with Pixels as well, shall we? Anyway, so it becomes like one-upmanship. Roman Lunyov wants his mother out of the care home, sends various assassins in to see this done, keeps failing. Marla Grayson is putting up her own kind of battle against him. It's a film where there's a point where you think there really is no winning here because there's no good. There isn't a good guy and a bad guy. They're both equally evil, reprehensible people. And you wonder what will be the moral outcome of this.
Actually raise Rebecca's heart rate to the extent that obviously her Apple Watch would identify the heart rate going up at any stage? I mean, you know, or would it be a case of, look, you're drowning, I don't care?
Not so much for this one. I did enjoy it. It wasn't as, gripping, in my opinion, as Escape from Pretoria. For me, I quite enjoyed the psychological thriller aspect of it. I think it was a really good concept to really focus on that, you know, abuse of guardianship. I think that was a really interesting story to be following. There were points, though, where I did feel like, you know, surely it's coming to an end now, and then it just didn't. And there was some... I just felt like there was a lack of resolution at points and a few plot holes. And, you know, the audience isn't stupid. They do pick up on that kind of thing. Absolutely. So that was my only critique for that. But I did enjoy it. I thought the characters were, you know, really, you know, got reattached to them. Rosamund Pike's character particularly. I know she was a cold, you know, really icy, as you say, villain. But I got really attached to her and I began... find myself, you know, really hoping that she was okay and, you know, following her journey. So I know I got really attached to her
for something that I thought was going to have a social conscience. It ended up being the sort of the caper kind of thing of, you know, the moral sort of compass of
okay,
an Ocean's 11 film.
Her partner is from Baby Driver. That's not good enough.
I knew I'd seen her somewhere, but I had to look her up. Yeah, I would give this one... I had such a good time watching it. I would give this one an 8, actually.
Mm. Quite.
I'm on a 6 for this, I'm afraid. But Richard Fitzwilliams...
I'd say 7.
No, I have to say, there are times when you get involved in a movie, even if you shouldn't be that involved in a movie, and even if the plot is, to some extent, rather absurd at times... because it's so wonderfully wicked. There we meet Marla Grayson, played by Rosamund Pike, an exceptionally good actress, as Robin said. And I mean, I love the way
she... Just think of the spread of coronavirus in that particular care home. It's unbelievable. They'd all be sort of going.
But it's the vaping that started to fascinate me. It's the power dressing. And you see, I mean, Robin, of course, was talking about the message of the movie. I mean, of course, she's supposed to be a capitalist vulture. And also, she's supposed, in a sense, to be a victim of the patriarchy, because the only way that in the society in which she finds herself, and of course, she's thoroughly evil, that she could possibly rise is, of course, through gains, which are very, very ill-gotten. And you've got this slightly bizarre situation, as Robin was saying, where you've got a doctor and person who runs a care home and Maria all combining so that elderly, vulnerable people are drugged and kept in a place that they'll probably die there. And of course, she makes a fortune on selling off their property and the like.
Thank you.
It's happening even as we speak. I can see people knocking at the door of the Pierce household, basically shipping Robin off, selling all the DVDs, selling all the sort of goodies, etc. By your leave.
One of the things that I mean, the word like probably isn't appropriate here, but I mean, when Maria Grayson goes to the home of Jennifer Peterson, who isn't, of course, who she they think she is, what is so shocking is the powers invested in a guardian where you don't need the person represented in court, since the doctor, who is fraudulent, will claim that the person isn't suffers from dementia and isn't always too ill. And when you've got this gangster like ring, and then you've got appearing are real gangsters and also diamonds. I would say an old person's best friend, one might think. I mean, there's also a surreal touch to this movie, which I like, because Peter Dinklage plays a Roman Lunyov, as Robin was saying, who's one of those gangsters who is very temperamental and strangely mannered. This says a lot about me, but I started being attracted to some of these monsters. I started getting rather fond of them. And there was a relationship, and I think that this is a very clever aspect to the movie. I like the music. I also like the visual tone of the movie, where you saw the colours, very, very strong colours. I thought that Maria's relationship with her partner in crime, and this was very clever, Fran, played by Eliza Gonzalez, there's a lesbian relationship there, and they are in love. And this is, I think, a very successful device to humanize the character. You could argue, certainly, that with Russian gangsters following you, however ballsy you are, you might very well cut and run. But that isn't the nature of certain plots. And the way this movie plays out, I thought was, until the end, no spoilers, absolutely delectable. I was just, you know, there's a certain wickedness in us all, and I'm sure in you, Alex. There is no art to know the mind's construction in the face, surely. So I really would give this 8. I agree it's not a perfect film, but my goodness me, it's an entertaining one.
Now, I stay with 6 because, again, I think the message was too traumatic in so many ways. And also, you never have lived that long in that kind of environment. When the gas has been turned on, you would have gone long ago. But never mind, that's by the by, let alone the actual drowning sequence. But what the hey? Okay, there we are. Award-winning, of course. It did pick up a Golden Globe for Rosamund Pike in terms of I Care a Lot.
Since you bring that up, what precisely did that prove? You mentioned it earlier with Jennifer Anderson. Please illustrate your own point.
Gillian Anderson, right, Richard? Let's get the name right. Yeah, Gillian Anderson. It's very important. Otherwise, we'll start confusing it with Pamela Anderson and then go back to the original X-Files scenario.
Gillian Anderson, illustrate your own point.
Yeah, well, obviously, it just shows that sometimes, you know, awards can be given for the most strangest of activities and indeed operations. Well done, Rosamund. You did well. But I think the script, I gotta say, leaves a lot to be desired. And of course, let's hope that's not seen as a template by the current governments to actually apply to care homes as a way of actually sort of speeding through the population fairly rapidly.
We ought, by the way, to mention a director, Jay Blakeson, who did The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which was, I thought, very successful with Gemma Arterton. So he's got a...
And Richard, as I'm well aware, you're clearly sort of still smitten by Gemma Arterton's performance as indeed Strawberry Fields in Quantum of Solace, because that's obviously another one which certainly stands out as one of her great productions.
That is a movie that is considered so bad that when defending the script, the excuse was there's a scriptwriter strike in Hollywood. It's all we could do.
That's brought us to the end of this particular sequence with inserts and musical pieces, of course, from both selected movies. Robin, has it been an okay session for yourself, sir?
I've enjoyed it as ever. Thank you.
Will you be keenly watching the Oprah Winfrey interview with the next Queen of England, Meghan Markle?
I will, out of a strange kind of fascination, because, you know, you always slow down if you see a car crash. I think this is what it's going to be. I think it's to add to what Richard said, I think you've got a culture clash here of the old dignified British culture, and this is being pitted against a more Kardashian-like celebrity culture, and it's not going to end well.
Well, let's hope it doesn't literally end in a car crash, even though Meghan is apparently wearing the same kind of eye makeup that indeed Harry's mum actually wore. So it'd be a bit traumatic from that point of view if we head down that particular area. Rebecca, will you be watching the interview, or is it a case of, no, my heart can't take it?
I think, like Robin said, out of fascination, I probably will. I mean, I've been seeing lots and lots about it on social media and on, you know, news notifications popping up on my phone. So I think to, you know, bring a bit of, not closure as such, but just to see what's actually happening from their perspective, I think would be interesting. So, yeah, I might give it a go.
And Richard, obviously, having watched the trailers, there's no point in you watching the actual main event. So presumably you'll be sort of passing it by completely.
Well, Alex, how right you are. I mean, I might, you know, if I'm really, really pushed to it. I do have to say that the extraordinary interest, I mean, only yesterday, Hong Kong television, Turkish television, a Canadian radio, I mean, the world is riveted by what's happening. And I think that, I mean, I do think, however, that we've heard bits of what, just a few seconds, really. What will be absolutely fascinating is to see the actual context. And I would make one reference, and that is to that trashy book, Finding Freedom, with David Scobie and Carolyn Durand, which they, in a circle, participated in with their consent. The Queen came out well out of that. The Prince of Wales, who's managed to escape opprobrium, have you noticed, quite interesting this during this whole business, because Harry's her son, after all, and came out perfectly well. They were cruel to the Cambridges. But my own bet, I don't know, and I think it will be sensational, and it will be a huge circus, and it is 2 hours. But I'm wondering how much is vitriol is actually going to be directed at the construct, as Meghan called the royal family. It's certainly a complete, as she still believes that she should have done an Oprah interview before the wedding and been truly liberated. Well, that isn't the way the royals do things. And as I've been attacked a lot on Twitter in recent days, I mean, one of the things that's quite interesting is that they have thousands of very, very devoted fans, and most of the press in Britain is against them. But of course, one must make this point, no point in being parochial. They're not aiming at Britain and the Commonwealth. They're aiming at the United States.
The establishment.
The establishment is an obvious target, but how personal will it get? It's the United States and the wider world they're aiming at. But what royals will be criticised, if any, and in what way?
But what a cracking way of actually improving your career after you'd been in Suits, though. I mean, surely, you know, it's a step forward. It's got to be a leap up from that. I suspect Golden Globe Award winning. That's my thought. Richard Fitzwilliams, happy trails for now. Any thoughts in terms of what we're doing next week in terms of movies, or have you not had a chance to even pursue that?
I haven't even had a chance. I think it's very unkind of you to throw that one at me at a time like this.
Well, it would seem that in the 21st century, certainly the notions of Falstaff, or certainly Billy Bunter, they wouldn't necessarily last too long in our current environment, and perhaps for good reason, because let's face it, if you are obese, morbidly obese, or indeed generally overweight, it's not a good time in any way, shape or form for your general health and so on. But what about that stigma that's often attached to, as I say, the kind of characters of literature and the kind of names that are actually used? Well, maybe one way of actually addressing this is to actually speak to the fabulous Professor David Kerrigan, President of the British Obesity and Metabolic Surgery Society. David, welcome this morning. And I presume, as I say, Falstaff or indeed Billy Bunter would be in problems or would be having trouble if they were around today.
They would be having troubles at the best of times, but at this particular moment in time with the COVID pandemic, they'd be in particular problems because, of course, we know that obesity and severe obesity particularly is one of the major risk factors for ending up in intensive care and dying should you contract COVID.
Now, allowing for that, clearly, I think most folk tend to sort of say, look, either it's not my fault, it's my genes and so on, but there is this stigma that is attached to folk. I mean, somehow there is this sense of, well, just stop eating, you know, just do more exercise, you know, and so on. And that's not necessarily helpful, is it?
No, not really. And it's an almost uniquely British thing as well. If you look at our continental partners, they don't seem to have this problem in recognising obesity as a disease. People here in this country think it's some kind of personal fault. We know that a recent survey showed that one in five people think that the reason people develop severe obesity is just because they're lazy. One in 10, amazingly, it's just because you've got a low IQ. Whereas in fact, we know it's a lot more nuanced than that. People get really, really big in terms of the levels where I might end up seeing them as a referral for surgery because they consume too many calories. No doubt about that at all. But the reasons why they consume too many calories are interesting. And it's usually some kind of trigger factor that's caused this. It might be an illness that's kind of laid them up for a long time. It may be an emotional thing, a mental health issue, some past trauma that's made people turn to food as a kind of comfort blanket. And the bottom line is that all of us have a kind of unique mechanism in our bodies that tells us when it's time to stop eating, that regulates energy and food intake. And people who develop really severe complex obesity, that switch off mechanism that tells you enough is enough just doesn't work anymore. So they can just keep eating without feeling full, without feeling that their hunger's gone away. And that at that point, when your body is not working as it should do, is pretty much the definition of a disease. And so we as sort of experts in this field really want to try and change the public's perception and this stigma that's out there, that this is all about personal failing and personal responsibility, and try and point out that it is actually a little bit more nuanced. And the reason some of these people are doing what they're doing to their bodies is because they don't have the same ability to switch off eating food through the appetite control mechanism that we should have. It just doesn't work normally in their case.
And in many ways, they're literally eating themselves to death, which is not good in any way, shape, or form. We've already talked about the correlation between obesity rates and indeed COVID-19, other issues relating to heart, also heart problems, cardio problems. I mean, the whole thing sort of rolls out from that point of view. Having said that, David, in terms of this perception that we actually have, I mean, we cover an awful lot of stories on the station which relates to obviously sugar being the new nicotine, processed foods not being good for you, a whole range of other factors. Is there also this sense of education is also a key factor in terms of at least knowing what is the kind of fuel you're putting into yourself actually doing to you, and actually being aware of the kind of nutrients also being critical to our understanding of obesity?
I mean, I totally agree that I think better food labeling of calories in food and alcohol and things like that is good, because sometimes there can be sort of hidden traps where I think people think they're doing something really healthy and actually they don't realize the hidden calories and what they're consuming. But do you know what? I think most people actually understand what good and bad food is. I think most people know when they're eating, you know, lots of really high fat fry ups and things like that, they're not doing the body much good. But the point about this is that if you have this insatiable hunger that you can't control, or you're just grazing and comfort eating constantly through the day, and that's often a more typical pattern than the person sitting down to a big slap up meal, the Falstaff image. It's just people who are nibbling and grazing and snacking on high calorie things all day long because, you know, they're miserable. It gives them comfort because they just feel hungry all the time. That's probably more the reason, I think, when people get to those kind of levels of severe obesity. But I think they're aware. I do think people, education is important to a degree, but I think most people do know these days that, you know, you can help yourself lose weight by eating less and moving more. But it's not as simple as that when you get to the stage where your BMI, your body mass index, is up in the sort of high 30s and 40s. At that point, it is a different animal. It's a disease at that point that we no real measure of diet and exercise is going to make a great deal of impact on that for most people. It will for some, rarely, but for most people, they need extra help at that point.
Prior to the COVID crisis, I think people used the phrase the obesity pandemic. Is that over simplifying the matter? Is that over dramatizing the case? Or is it a case of it's a Western disease, as you rightly said, because, you know, one looks at a number of other countries in the world who don't seem to have these kind of levels, as we already mentioned. Is this something where, you know, we need to obviously, as has indeed been the case, start bringing in drastic action to actually start addressing these issues? Or do we just kind of shrug our shoulders and say, well, I could always choose to go for gastric surgery if required?
Well, I mean, you've got to look at, I think, at obesity on two levels. On a societal level, in terms of how do we manage the impact of obesity on our society and our NHS, and also on an individual level, what's the impact of that disease on that particular person? And from the NHS's perspective, this sort of growth in obesity, I mean, two-thirds of UK adults at the moment are either overweight or obese. That's amazing. And just over a quarter of adults have severe obesity. In terms of bariatric surgery, what I specialise in, obviously that's only a tip of the iceberg, people who would be eligible for that, but that's still 2 million UK adults are eligible for bariatric surgery. And in this country, we do about 5,000 or 6,000 operations a year, hardly making any impact on that at all. But the NHS should, I think, look more closely at investing in effective treatments. Bariatric surgery has really been under the microscope by NICE, the government's regulatory body, looking at how well treatments work. And it's come out as one of the most cost-effective healthcare interventions across the board. And yet we don't really invest in it because we think, well, it was all their own fault. We shouldn't be spending the NHS's money on them. They've done it to themselves. This stigma starts to creep in. But if you take that attitude, I can tell you now, obesity is going to bankrupt the NHS at some point, because it's not just heart disease or diabetes or the increased risk of cancer and things like that that is associated with severe obesity. It's the cost of treating these things. I mean, just one of those. Let's take type 2 diabetes, very, very strongly associated with obesity. And type 2 diabetes at the moment costs the NHS, wait for it, £1 million every hour of every single day. £1 million an hour, just treating type 2 diabetes. Now, if we've got somebody who's got severe complex obesity and diabetes, we can do a bariatric operation on the NHS for £7,000. And that £7,000 will get rid of the diabetes in about 70% of those individuals within about a month. So it's just a financial no-brainer. You can either carry on spending £1 million an hour treating the disease, or you can actually get rid of the disease by spending £7,000 on a bariatric op. And I think people need to get their heads around this and stop stigmatizing the individual and start dealing with the problem and treating it.
We've frequently heard, of course, that the pharmaceutical industry, as you might expect, very much interested in this whole challenge. And I'm sure there are lots of folk who actually say, yes, well, they cause it at one end and then they try to solve it at the other. Is that something where, when we hear about magic bullet pills to actually suppress appetites and so on, is that just a case of, well, it's nice in theory, but it's not as effective necessarily as it's made out to be?
Yeah, the pharmaceutical industry have poured billions into research in, because everybody thinks, well, if we can get a tablet we can all take that keeps us all nice and slim, that's going to make them all a lot of money. They haven't had much joy, to be honest, because the one tablet that's currently licensed at the moment, it's been around for years, it causes unpleasant side effects, it doesn't work that well. However, there are some exciting new pharmaceutical products actually in the pipeline. There's a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of weeks ago looking at a once a week injection that actually mimics the effect of bariatric surgery. Bariatric surgery helps, actually, not by strangling your stomach and stopping you eating, it actually makes your body produce a hormone, a chemical signal in the blood that controls appetite. It puts right the fault, this faulty appetite control. So the surgery actually makes your stomach produce more of a certain type of hormone or signal that goes to the brain and makes you stop feeling hungry, basically. The pharmaceutical industry have actually managed to manufacture a synthetic version of this hormone. And they've got it to the point now where you can have an injection of this once a week, and it's actually very effective. Patients in this trial lost about 15% of their total body weight over a year on this injection. So I think that is potentially an avenue going forwards to help people. However, the cost is high. The cost of 2 years of treatment on those injections is more than the cost of, say, a gastric bypass operation. So you've kind of got to look at the health economics of this. But I think pharmaceuticals definitely going to be coming to the fore over the next 5 years. We'll be hearing a lot more of them.
Well, I suppose good news for people who have stocks and shares in the industries. Let's move on. Where can people find out further information, David, about what we've been chatting about today? And indeed, if they are considering the notion of actually having surgery and want to actually address that more effectively.
Yeah, so there's some good websites, patient support websites for people who are considering bariatric surgery, such as Obesity UK. Diabetes, if you're diabetic, Diabetes UK have a great website. The NHS website itself is really useful for general information about obesity management. But I think first stop is probably go and speak to your GP. And therein lies part of the problem, because healthcare professionals, doctors and nurses like me, actually also have their own stigma sometimes against patients who are suffering with severe obesity. So going to see your GP just to talk about your weight can be a very daunting prospect, and people don't do it. And actually, on the other side of the coin, GPs often find it very difficult and a bit embarrassing to talk to their patients about their patients' weight because they don't want to cause offence. And we're locked into this little cycle where nobody's really talking about it. And pardon the pun, you know, we're ignoring the elephant in the room. And therefore, people are not getting access to proper treatment. But that is your best bet. Go and see your GP. There should be some local specialist weight management clinics in your area, if you have particularly severe problem with obesity, which the GP can refer you into, and they can try you on some of the medications I've mentioned. They can try you with some psychological support and dietary intervention. And if you do okay on those programs, or if it just doesn't work for you because it's just the wrong approach to treatment for you, then those specialist clinics can then refer you on to an NHS bariatric surgeon for consideration of surgery. It's not possible for your GP to make that referral straight to the surgeon. You have to go through this specialist medical weight management clinic first.